All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be your host today, which is really exciting for me. So today's program is going to be talking about a couple of things. One is going to be about a business that we have picked up as a sponsor that supports the certification of veteran-owned businesses, and I'll get into that in just a minute. And so that's an interview we had the opportunity to talk to the president of that organization earlier this week, so that's going to be a recorded one. But what's really going to be coming on later in the program is the opportunity to talk to a young author named John Hollis. And John has written a book entitled Sergeant Rodney M. Davis, The Making of a Hero. And Sergeant Davis received the Medal of Honor for action in Vietnam in 1967. And I think that this is really appropriate considering the times that we're in over the last week especially. So I wanted to make sure that you stay tuned for that story. Obviously, Sergeant Davis was a Black Marine in Vietnam, and he smothered a grenade with his body. And the other people in the trench with him when he smothered a grenade were all white. And so I think that's kind of an interesting story that we'll get to toward the bottom of the hour. But right now I wanted to give a little shout out to a local veterans organization, and I think this is really kind of cool. So I wanted to give a shout out to the Ypsilanti American Legion Post 282. And what they have been doing for the last month, month and a half now, is that they've been handing out free food. They hand out food on Saturdays from noon till 2 at 100 Ecorse Road. They've been doing this since mid-April, and they're hoping to continue it through the month of June. So I just wanted to give this. This is all raised, all the food and all the money and everything else is raised by the members of American Legion Post 282. And again, that this food is handed out free, entirely free, on Saturdays from noon till 2 o'clock at 100 Ecorse Road in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And again, I wanted to make sure that we got that out there. Great job, guys, American Legion Post 282. I also wanted to make sure that I let you know about our sponsors here on Veterans Radio. And that includes Legal Help for Veterans, who specializes in veterans disability claims. For more information, you can go to their website. That's legalhelpforveterans.com. Or give them a call at 800-693-4800. And I did want to welcome the support of our new support, I guess you could say, of the National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as the NVBDD. NVBDC. They're new sponsors. I'll get this right sooner or later. All right, so the NVBDC main purpose is to certify that a veteran-owned business is just that. It's actually veteran-owned. And this can be very important for veteran-owned companies that want to do business with the federal government and with veteran-friendly corporations. So for more information, stick around for the interview with the president of the organization. But also, you can give them a call at 888-CERTIFIED. That's 888-237-8434, or you can go to their website, nvbdc.org. Also, we want to thank U.S. Wings, the manufacturers of the finest leather jackets in the world. U.S. Wings is a major supplier of leather flight jackets to the military. For more information, you can go to their website, that's uswings.com. You can also go to the website now, and they're manufacturing protective masks. So go to uswings.com and check those out. And, of course, we want to thank our local veterans organizations here in the Ann Arbor area. That would be American Legion Post 46, VFW Post 423, and Charles S. Kettles VVA Post 310, all of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And so I wanted to make sure we got that in. Thank you, guys, for all of your support. Without you, we couldn't be on the program. We're going to take a real quick break right now, and then we're going to go to a pre-recorded interview that I did with the president of the National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as the NVBDC. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the interview with General Miller. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Thomas Redd.
The Rascal Flatts.
Hey, this is Jake Owen.
This is Florida Georgia Line.
Hey, this is Charlie Daniels.
Fisher House gives wounded warriors, veterans, and military families a no-cost place to stay during a medical crisis. The homes are built right on the grounds of major VA and military medical centers. The design helps people get together and make friends and support one another. You can help. Find out how at fisherhouse.org.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Okay, and we are back here on Veterans Radio, and as I mentioned, I had the opportunity to pre-record an interview earlier this week with the president of the National Veterans Business Development Council, and that is Richard Dick Miller. And Dick Miller was a retired brigadier general, and I'm just going to go to the interview, as I said here. So here is Dick Miller talking with me earlier in the week about the National Veterans Business Development Council. All right, we're here on Veterans Radio, and our guest today is a retired general, Richard Dick Miller. He is the president of the National Veteran Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC. And I'm talking with Mr. Miller today to talk about what the organization is and what exactly it does. So, Dick, let's get started here. So tell me a little bit about what the NVBDC is.
Well, it's, again, the National Veteran Business Development Council. We're a nonprofit 501c3 organization. We were founded to facilitate veteran-owned businesses doing business with corporate America. And we're very proud of the fact that we have been very successful in the 6 years that we've been in existence. And it's a veteran organization run by veterans for veterans. And that's not just something we say, it's something we mean. Most of us, well, as a matter of fact, practically all of us are veterans. And we, you know, we have a passion for trying to help our veteran-owned businesses. Now, the African-American, Hispanic, and other organizations have been involved with diversity spend with corporations for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we're the new guy to the table. But one of the things we share is the fact that our constituency, which is veteran-owned businesses, we transcend all ethnic, racial, gender. And the fact of the matter is we feel very strongly about promoting these veteran-owned businesses.
Right. And the idea was, I thought it was originally that in order to do business with the federal government, you needed to be certified. Is that correct? Is that kind of where this spun off from?
Well, it spun off from that, yes. The advent of veterans being considered a diverse class of people is relatively new compared to the others. And let me rephrase that. You do not have to be certified by the federal government. In many cases, depending on the contracts, whether it's the VA, DOD, other entities, whether or not they choose to have you participate. What they do, though, is they set aside a certain percentage of their overall spend for diverse organizations, whether it be women, veterans, really doesn't matter. But at the end of the day, what we found and the reason we got started was that corporate America will not accept the government's certification of veterans. And we were approached by a number of these major corporations saying, hey, can you guys put together a program similar to what we call the NMSDC, the National Minority Supplier Development Council, and there's another organization called WeBank, Women Business Enterprise, and if you can put together something robust that has a high degree of integrity, then we're happy to support veterans.
Okay. Well, one of the issues that as I was reading all your materials, was that previously, before your organization began, there were some, quote, veteran-owned businesses that were out there that had a token veteran as head of it, but they really didn't have anything to do with the running of the business. And it sounds like your process is much more in depth as far as finding out who is actually running and who owns the corporation. Is that correct?
Well, it most certainly is. And again, we were mentored, thankfully, by the NMSDC as well as the WeBank. And we actually sat through their process. We modeled ours after theirs, with a few exceptions having to do with veterans. But fraud is unbelievable. And you would think that even with the veteran community, we wouldn't have fraud, but unfortunately we do. And so what you end up with are millions of dollars worth of contracts that are awarded either to sham companies or where they put a figurehead in place. The person never shows up and they get to claim that for, you know, going after government business.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue comes down to, and you may or may not be aware, but the most downloaded government document in the United States government is the DD-214, which is the history of your military service.
Right.
And you can go online and literally fill it out and print it off. And so an organization like ours, we have a very, very stringent program. And we look at basically the bottom line for all of this is ownership and control. We actually look at who's running the business. We ask for financials. We look for independence. You know, do you actually own? You have to have 51% of the ownership. But we also then visit the corporation and we actually, you know, prove it to us. Prove us that you're actually running the business. And none of this stuff about, it's not my office. I borrowed this office today. Well, that, you know, not going to cut it. Yeah. But we ask for financials. We ask for background. We have all of the checks and checks and balances that you would, in many cases, people would say is really onerous and it really is intrusive. But you know what? With the fraud, it is unbelievable. Again, we are going to make sure that our integrity, when we put our stamp on this thing, that you are indeed a veteran. The thing that separates us is the fact that we require the DD-214 to come from the government. We won't accept the DD-214 from the individual. And again, that's all got to do with fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been pretty lucky so far. I mean, we've had you're familiar with the term honorable discharge, right?
I am, yes, sir.
Yeah.
I got one of those.
Well, thank you for your service.
You too.
But we actually had a DD-214 come in where the person had whited out honorable or whited out dishonorable and typed in honorable.
Oh, my.
And, you know, you say, you know, and that's why veterans reading a DD-214, we know what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have a person on our staff that compiled the DD-214s at the Pentagon. And so between all of us, Vietnam vets, I'm a war on terror vet, but a lot of us are either Vietnam or something, but we're all veterans. And so we know how to read a DD-214.
Yeah, we do. We do. We know right where to go, where you served, what you did, what your, your MOS was and all those different things. We're talking with retired Brigadier General Richard Miller here. He is the president of the National Veteran Business Development Council, better known as the NVBDC. And we're talking about the idea here of a national organization that certifies that a veteran-owned business is actually a veteran-owned business because as Dick was talking about, there has been a lot of cases of fraud out there. Look, can you kind of walk me through the process real quickly of Veterans Radio is a veteran-owned business.
Oh, very good.
Yes, there are three of us, and so if we wanted to apply for membership to the organization, what would be the process, or how would we get that started?
Well, you would visit our website. It's NVBDC.org.
Right. Got
it. And okay, you go to certification, and it walks you right through the process. And it really is, we've invested several hundreds of thousands of dollars here in the last year and a half to automate this, and it really is a pretty good system. So it's pretty intuitive. We do have staff that can answer any of your questions as you go through this. And we do charge a processing fee, depending on how big your organization is. At the low end, it's $350, and $100 million and up is $2,500. So there's a range in between there. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's a pretty reasonable, but you know, at the end, we have to pay staff. And
yeah, everybody has to, we understand that.
Yeah.
It's like a doctor's office. You got to pay the nurses too.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. But you know, at the end of it all, once you go through, we do indeed look at, you know, are you bonded? Do you, DD-214s? We look at bank information, business references. We look at, you know, tax IDs, certificates of, stock. And you know, it's fascinating because we look at the depth that we do, I'll just share a story with you. We had an organization out of Chicago that veteran owned business, very successful one, by the way. And I went to visit with him, and the president of the company was an Iraqi war vet and a really good guy. And, you know, it was determined within minutes that this guy was running his business, and it was a very impressive business. So I brought to his attention. I said, well, you do know that your stock, all of your stock is in your dad's name. And if he dies, it all goes to your mother. Which means you, by the way, the dad thankfully was a Marine Corps veteran from World War II. And I said, you do know that you then have, you do not own the business. What do you mean? I've been the president for 5 years. I said, well, that's okay. And I understand that. But it also speaks to the fact that we're not out to not certify people. These are fellow veterans, and we're going to go out of our way to help these folks be successful, right?
Absolutely.
So his dad just happened to be there, and we all sat down, and I said, you know, let me just explain the facts of life to you here. What I'd really like you to do is you guys need to get with your lawyers. I'm not telling you how to run your business, but you need to get with your lawyers. And by the way, the dad didn't realize it either, because we don't look just at the current situation. If for example, if the wife is 50% owner and you're 50% owner and you get a divorce, what happens to the business?
Right, yes.
So there's a lot of that stuff that happens. So thankfully, 2 weeks later, we got a notarized letter from that organization. They had changed the whole stock process, and this young man indeed now owns the business. And, you know, if I can – go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say that. Sounds, I mean, that's what many many business owners need to know, that, you know, sometimes their structure isn't quite set up the way they thought it was. And,
right.
You know, and it's, you know, they're not protected in the way that they thought that they were. And it sounds as though the NVBDC goes out there, and not only are you trying to get them certified in order to hopefully increase their business, but also to make sure that they are set up where the business will run in a good fashion, because, you know, many, many people do not have, you know, the carry on paperwork in order if something does happen to an owner and so forth, that, you know, what does happen in case of this or in case of that. I think it's great. You know, we are talking today on Veterans Radio about the National Veteran Business Development Council, and their mission is to certify veteran-owned businesses. And we're doing this because we are in the process of setting up a relationship with the NVBDC, and hopefully in the next few months that we were going to have some good success cases that we can talk about on Veterans Radio for people that
Great.
You have helped to get certified. I realize I'm kind of blindsiding you here, and you mentioned the one in Chicago, but can you think of some other let's start off with a relatively small business that you have been successful in getting them certified and how it helped them out.
Well,
without names.
No, that's fine. I don't necessarily handle the whole certification side of the business, but I will tell you that we have helped a number where, well, I guess I could tell you one. There was a small organization, three-person organization out of Nashville, Tennessee, and I went to visit them, and they were in an office with somebody else. Mm-hmm. But they clearly had their business, and it was a clear example of a startup operation. And they made American-made products, but they're in the apparel industry, like polo shirts, you know, all of that sort of thing. But the all they do is provide American-made products. And we got them set up, and then I sent a couple of emails out to some folks. And before I got to the airport, I got a note from the president of that company saying he had already had three inquiries about buying things from his business.
Oh, great. That's terrific.
So the other thing we do on a bigger scale is, I'm not sure if you're aware, but we were able to garner $2 billion worth of revenue for our veteran-owned businesses in 2019.
Wow.
And we have gotten...
That's great. That is terrific.
Yeah, and that's real numbers. And we have gotten commitments from major corporations to the tune of, if they come through with everything they said they will, is an $80 billion opportunity for our veteran-owned businesses.
Wow. I guess I've got to really say, folks, if you're listening to this, I really encourage you to go out and check out this website. It's nvbdc.org and find out all the information that is going on. I was looking at your 2020 plans, which have kind of been, you know, thrown askew as a result of the, you know, the virus epidemic and so forth, and that you were going to have a huge business conference, I think it was. Are you going to be trying to do that later in the year, or are you going to be trying to do it virtually? Or,
well, right now, as you know, we're all from Michigan. We all understand the circumstances. We certainly are going to still try to do it. We have an annual event every November, and last year was a rousing success. We had it in Columbus, Ohio, and it was a packed house, and we had several hundred veteran-owned businesses show up to our event. And then we had, of course, our sponsors. We have BMW, we have GM, Chrysler, and Ford. We have, on the other side of the coin, we have Google, we have Apple, we have Amazon, are all sponsors of ours. So we run the gamut from technology companies all the way through the automotive companies. Walmart, I mean, you name it. We don't have them all, but we certainly have a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, as a matter of fact, our good friend at Apple says, you know, $1 billion for them is a rounding error.
Right. That's very true. But the idea that you have access to these corporations and that they are looking to help veterans, especially it seems like in the business community today that there are many, many people that do want to help out veteran-owned businesses. And with the process that you take these companies through to get certified, which is the magic word here, is certified, so that they can verify that they actually are a veteran-owned company, so that we don't end up with the, you know, the stolen honor people and the frauds and everything else that are out there trying to piggyback on what veterans have done over the years and are trying to continue to do today. I think it's really exciting, Dick, and I'm anxious to talk with you folks more in the future.
Well, we're excited also. And, you know, Keith King is the founder of this organization, and it's a vision that he had. And I always joke that if you look at the organizational structure, I was employee number one, you know. We met at a Starbucks at 12 Mile and Mound Road, and he said, "Hey, here's what I'd like to do. Are you interested in joining me for the ride?" And that was roughly 6 years ago.
That's terrific. I got to point out, you know, that Dick Miller that we're talking to was, as I mentioned, was a brigadier general retired from the United States Army and the National Guard for over 30 years. Ultimately, you became the deputy commanding general of the 38th Infantry Division of the Indiana National Guard. That's quite the resume right there.
Well, it was a great ride. If I would have liked to have done it longer, but there is a point in time where, you know, you got to move over and let some younger folks come up.
That's true. That is very true. We're finding that as we go through life ourselves. You never want to give up the control, but it is the best thing to do in many cases. So, Dick, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio today. And as I said, we will be in touch with you in the future to find out more about what's going on with the National Veteran Business Development Council, better known as the NVBDC. I encourage our audiences to go to your website, that's nvbdc.org, to find out more information. And as we move into the future, Dick, I look forward to talking with you and Keith and the rest of the command control system there at your organization to get some more stories, some success stories that we can get out to our listeners and encourage more veteran-owned businesses to contact you to get themselves certified as well.
Well, thank you so much. And again, we're very sincere about helping our fellow veterans become successful.
I can understand that, and it's great to have an organization like yours out there. Thank you very much for being on our program, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Hey, you too. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we just finished that interview with the president of the National Veteran Business Development Council. That was Dick Miller, and as I mentioned before, we've just started a partnership up with this organization ourselves, and so they're going to be on the program periodically over the next 6 months or so, hopefully bringing success stories about how they have been able to help veteran-owned businesses and what that certification really means to you and your organization. So stick around. We will be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Okay, I just wanted to thank Dick Miller for being on our program and doing that interview earlier in the week. Coming up next is a really fascinating story that I think is really important for all of us. And we're going to be talking with an author, John Hollis, and he's written a book entitled Sergeant Rodney M. Davis, The Making of a Hero, the Medal of Honor recipient from Vietnam. So stick around for that, and we will be right back.
Hey, I'm Willie Nelson.
Thousands of veterans are living on our streets right now where they're being robbed, beaten, and even killed. And if this happened behind enemy lines, we'd be outraged. So please help us get our veterans into safe, permanent housing. Donate any amount at veteransmatter.org. Or you can text VETS to 41444. They fought for us, and now we fight for them. Veterans Matter.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Sergeant David Bleek, although a medical aid man, killed three North Korean soldiers and disarmed two more. Details after this.
Okay. For conspicuous gallantry and jeopardy at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty, while serving as the right guide of the 2nd Platoon Company B in action against enemy forces, elements of the 2nd Platoon were pinned down by a numerically superior force of attacking North Vietnamese Army regulars. Remnants of the platoon were located in a trench line where Sergeant Davis was directing the fire of his men in an attempt to repel the enemy attack. Disregarding the enemy hand grenades and high volumes of small arms and mortar fire, Sergeant Davis moved from man to man, shouting words of encouragement to each of them while firing and throwing grenades at the onrushing enemy. When an enemy grenade landed in the trench in the midst of his men, Sergeant Davis, realizing the gravity of the situation and in a final valiant act of complete self-sacrifice, instantly threw himself upon the grenade, absorbing with his body the full and terrific force of the explosion. Through his extraordinary initiative and inspiring valor in the face of almost certain death, Sergeant Rodney Davis saved his comrades from injury and possible loss of life, enabled his platoon to hold its vital position, and upheld the highest traditions of the Marine Corps and the United States Naval Service. He gallantly gave his life for his country. Today's program, or today's second half of our program, is going to be talking about Sergeant Rodney Davis. And joining me on the program right now is author John Hollis. And John has written a great book called Sergeant Rodney Davis, The Making of a Hero. So, John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Great. Dale, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here, and I think it's fantastic what you guys do for the veterans and, you know, to highlight Medal of Honor recipients especially. So, you know, anything I can do to help contribute to that makes me proud. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. So let's talk about Rodney Davis.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about him, where he came from, and how he ended up in Vietnam, if you could.
Sure. Sure. Rodney grew up in Macon, Georgia. He was the second oldest of five children born to Ruth Amanda and Gordon Davis in Macon, Georgia. And the beauty of the story is, you know, they grew up in the Jim Crow South. And so, of course, being the way things were, he was the second oldest. He and his brothers were charged with looking out for one another, no matter where they went, because in the age of Jim Crow, the threat of violence or humiliation was everywhere you went when you went outside the house. So looking after his brothers was something he grew up doing. And ultimately, he would die the way he lived, looking out for his new brothers in the U.S. Marine Corps. After graduating from high school in 1961, Rodney joined the Marine Corps, rose to the ranks. He was serving as an embassy guard in London for 3 years, from 1961 to 1964, or 1964 rather, 1967. But like most Marines, when there's fighting going on and shooting starting, he volunteered for duty in Vietnam, and he arrived in Vietnam on August 14th, 1967. He was killed 3 weeks later, September 6th, 1967, for one of the bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War, which is part of Operation Swift.
Well, that's the Reader's Digest version of it. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, you mentioned in the book, you talk about how important family life was to him.
Sure.
And how, you know, important it was growing up in Macon, Georgia, mm-hmm. during the Jim Crow era. And, you know, that the Marines, to him, it seemed like was a way out of there.
It was. The Marine Corps offered opportunities to young African-Americans that they didn't have in lots of parts of America, particularly in the Deep South, a chance to get an education, a chance to travel, see the world. In fact, Rodney, you know, traveled all over. He was part of the a Marine contingent that was off the shore of Cuba in 1962 as part of the Bay of Pigs, ready to invade Cuba, had President Kennedy given the okay. So he traveled the world, went to London, met his future wife, and had a 1 and 2 year old daughters, 2 1-year-old daughters in London. Met them in London. They moved to Macon. But family was everything to Rodney. I mean, he grew up with his brothers. His older brother is 18 months older, was his best friend. Looking after his brothers, they were all so close, and family was everything. And to the entire Davis family, to this day, remains everything. And so for him, looking out for your own, taking care of your own, doing whatever you need to do to take care of your family was the way he lived his life. And so for people who later wonder how he could he jump on a grenade, particularly he'd only been in country 3 weeks when he was killed, for people he didn't know or just barely met. But that's who Rodney Davis was. And, you know, he wasn't going to change whether he's in Macon or in Vietnam. But looking after his own is something he had always done his whole life. And he died as nobly as he lived.
Well, that is certainly true. And I was just really interested in reading this whole story. And I it's funny when you've reminded me here that it was only 3 weeks of being in country. And that, for some reason, I didn't pick up on that. I just assumed that he had been there for a while. The assignments that he had, or especially the assignment in London, must have been really an eye-opening experience for him.
It really was. I mean, he saw, you know, before he and his family had grown up in Macon and really hadn't really been anywhere. So this is an eye-opening. Not only leaving Georgia, but leaving the United States altogether and seeing an entirely different world. It was different for him, but, you know, like anything else, he was lonely at first, missed his family because he had spent like every holiday, particularly the Christmas holiday, the Davis family to this day gathers in mass to celebrate the birth of Christ with one another. And so I've read a lot of his letters. His sister kept a lot of his letters home when he was in overseas, and even when he was at Camp Lejeune, she kept all of his letters home. And he talked about how lonely he was, how he missed his family, particularly on those holidays, because they knew they were all together back in Macon, Georgia, and here he was, you know, in a whole different world, a whole different life. But he got used to it, and he grew up. I mean, he became a man, saw the world, and he loved his country. He loved his fellow Marines. You know, they were obviously knew what was going on in America as far as the Jim Crow laws, as far as all the racial unrest going on. But he loved his country, and he loved his fellow Marines, and that's first and foremost. He had actually been 13 years old, but he and his brother walking through Macon, Georgia, saw a Marine recruiting poster, and he told his brother, "Someday I'm going to be a U.S. Marine." So that was always his life's dream. After he graduated from high school, he came back and told his mom and dad, after he signed all the papers, "I'm going to be enlisting the U.S. Marine Corps." And they were a little stunned, but his dad, who was a former Navy man who had served in World War II, kind of understood. Rodney wanted to get out, see the world, and really test his mettle, and he thought the U.S. Marine Corps was the way to do that.
Well, the reason I thought that this book was really timely, of course, is what's been going on over the last week here as well. And the idea of 1967, I can remember 1967 myself. It's just before I went into the service, and there were a number of riots. I'm from New Jersey originally, and there were riots in Newark and
everywhere.
Even a little town, near where I lived at the time, and I turn around and I look outside today, and I see many of the same similar problems, that are being faced by minorities here in America, and I'm hoping that people will take the opportunity to read this book, because this young man, I think it would be a privilege to have known him. And yep. I know that there are so many people in the military and the Marines especially that, there are no color lines, in combat, because you don't have time for it, for one thing. And the other thing is that the person that is to your left or your right is the one that's going to save your life.
Exactly. That was the beauty of this whole story. You talked about all the race riots. I mean, the issue of black and white had pushed this country in 1967 closer to anarchy than at any point in our nation's history since the Civil War. There were more than 150 cities that had race riots. The issue of black and white was so contentious. People forget that Thurgood Marshall was just confirmed to the Supreme Court 6 days before Sergeant Davis was killed. The issue of black and white was so contentious that Lyndon B. Johnson, who's president, but he's a former Senate Majority Leader, had convinced 20 U.S. senators not to vote in the Supreme Court confirmation process. Can you imagine any situation today where one-fifth of the U.S. Senate body does not vote for fear of alienating their base? That's how contentious the issue of race was. But 10,000 miles away, the irony is almost palpable. 10,000 miles away, the closest thing to hell on earth, these guys had it right. It didn't matter, like you said, it didn't matter what color was the guy next to you, as long as he's got your six. It didn't matter what he's from. What his color was, what his daddy did, nothing. They were brothers in every sense. Young Americans trying to survive, still in the same blood, in the same mud.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's go look at that day, because mm-hmm. there's a whole lot of things that occurred after it as well.
Sure.
So Sergeant Davis, he's a sergeant now.
Yes, sir.
And I'd be curious, did you get any indication that you thought that maybe he was going to make a career of the Marines?
I think so. I think at first he went in, at least letters I've read, he kind of went in thinking maybe I'd do 4 years. But then he started making rank, and he started, of course, things are a little better when you make a little rank on you, too.
Sure.
So I think he would have. I mean, I can't say that for certain, but it seemed like he certainly would have. He'd been in 6 years when he could have gotten out and volunteered for duty in Vietnam. So I think, mm-hmm. It was just something he thought he was best in the world trained at, and that was what we meant to do.
All right. So let's take it up to early September 1967 in the Quezon Valley, and I think that's in I Corps. I was down in 3 Corps,
yes,
so I'm not familiar with
it. Near the DMZ.
Okay. So he's up there, and they inadvertently walked into an ambush.
Correct. The combat had started, Operation Swift had started 2 days earlier, September 4th, 1967. They had had a major battle, basically in the Quezon Valley. It was a very strategic importance to both sides, because it had lots of rice and lots of potential conscripts for the North Vietnamese. So they desperately were trying to get in the area, grab young men, grab all the food and rice, feed and everything else, and basically have places to hide and hide and support their troops. And so the MACB, and then the 1st Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment in there to try to combat them and fight them. They had a major fight September 4th, 1967, which was the bloodiest day of the 1-5's entire tenure of the war. More than 100 Marines were killed that day. Something like 50-something or so were wounded. It was a huge, huge battle. But the Marines won, but only because they had decisive advantages in air power and artillery. The NVA crossed back across the border, and most Marines kind of figured that was it, because the North Vietnamese typically did not want to engage in direct head-to-head fights with the American forces, because the Americans did have the advantage in air power and technology. And so when they went on the patrol September 6th, they just assumed that they were going to basically clean up operations. They did not expect a major fight that day, and literally walk right into a buzzsaw. That Bravo Company, 200 Marines, literally walk right into it. After leaving one of the little villages, they walked out into a rice paddy, and all hell broke loose. And there was an estimated 2,500 men lying in wait for those 200 Marines. It was ugly.
I tell you, it raised the hair on the back of my neck when I was reading that that whole thing. I was fortunate enough not to be in the infantry, so I wasn't down there in the mud with them. But it's just frightening to imagine what these young men had to go through.
I can't even fathom. And the thing which kills me is, like, they all, you know, interviewed over 50 Marines who were there that day, and almost to a man, each one of them said, "I wasn't a hero, but I served with guys who were." And I was like, "No offense, but you were all heroes, because I can't imagine what I would do in that situation." And you can think of it all you want, but until you're in that situation, you just don't know. But those guys were literally facing waves and waves of North Vietnamese soldiers running at them. They were cutting them down like crazy, and they just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming. The only reason any of them survived at all is because they had air power and artillery, which they always would bring to bear as the NVA crossed the rice paddy. Sergeant Davis' platoon started September 6th with 48 men, including a two-man machine gun team, two machine gunners, a two-man sniper team, and a forward artillery observer. By the end of the day, the end of September 6th, only 11 remained, with eight of those later receiving Purple Hearts or gunshot or shrapnel wounds. So it's almost 100% casualties. The fact that any of them survived at all is truly a miracle. It is truly a miracle. And I've been a journalist my entire life, Dale. I was at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I was a sports writer mostly. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, I've written the Time magazine, done a little bit of everything else. But those are the hardest interviews I've ever done in my life, trying to talk to these gentlemen, asking detailed questions about the most horrific day of their lives, but yet still you need to understand that it was the most horrific day they've ever experienced, and, you know, be sensitive to that. It was the hardest thing I ever did. And they cried like babies talking to me, and I cried like babies almost the entire time as well. And I remember telling my wife at the time, like, you'd be a human if you heard this story and you didn't cry.
Oh, I know we do a lot of collection of stories here on Veterans Radio, and I can't tell you how many times I've cried along with the people trying to tell their stories. And it's, these are such traumatic events that these men and women have gone through. And yep. to dredge them up in many cases and to get them to tell their stories so we can find out the true story of, yep. In this case, you know, Sergeant Davis, and you know, in other cases, other people of Medal of Honor recipients, to try and get the, you know, the true story of what happened on that day is always so difficult in many ways, because you don't want to impose on them, but you got to get that story out of them. And
it was hard. One of the Marines is a guy named Randy Leadham. He's still alive, living in the Portland, Oregon area. He had been in the hospital with malaria the day before, had never even met Sergeant Davis, or much have said one word to him. They'd never even been introduced or anything. And throughout the chaos of combat, they ended up beside one another in that trench. And he lived only because Sergeant Davis jumped on that grenade. At one point, he's describing to me, because they weren't expecting full-blown operation, he was only given three magazines of 18 rounds apiece. He quickly ran out of ammunition, obviously. And he's describing to me being on all fours, walking on the bloodstained ground, picking up fallen magazines or rifles from other fallen Marines to survive. He has nightmares to this day, every night. I cry when he told me that.
Well,
I can't even imagine something that horrible. I can't.
Yes. Well, let's try to describe the last moments then of Sergeant Davis's life.
Sure. Basically, the NVA, the Marines were cutting them down in waves, but there were just so many, and there were trenches built all over the country that dated back to the Vietnamese fighting the French years and years earlier. But they're using the trenches and getting as close as they can, and the bullet fire was coming so heavily, the Marines couldn't even stand up to fire. They were just standing above the trench, putting their guns above the trench in many cases, and firing towards that direction because the fire was that heavy. And they were inching so close, they could hear their voices and hear them moving, you know, creeping up closer and closer. Finally, the NVA got so close, they started tossing grenades at the Marines. And they would usually, it was like a, you know, one Marine described it as like a wordless ballet. The grenades would land in the trench. The Marines would jump out of the trench as the grenades would go off. Then small arms and mortar fire would start up again, and then hop back in the trench. It was like a back and forth. But finally, the worst part is two grenades came at them. One went high, but it made the Marines lower their heads, and they lost track of the second one. It hit one of the other Marines in the leg, fell into their trench. With all the chaos going on, all the shooting, the cacophony of noises everywhere. The other Marines were shooting at NVA all around them. They did not see or hear the grenade that landed in their feet, at their feet in the trench beside them. Sergeant Davis is the only one who saw it. He jumped on it, used both hands, pulled it underneath himself as to absorb the entire lethal blast. and exploded and killed him. But he saved the lives of those five Marines. He didn't hesitate, and the fact that he didn't hesitate, in fact, he knew what he was doing because he used both hands to stuff it underneath his body. And there were several number of Marines who were nearby, saw the entire thing, and verified as much. He died instantly without saying a word.
That's the most amazing part of this whole story is that, you know, not just jumping on a grenade, but pulling it under you to protect those around you when you know that it's going to kill you.
He knew what he's doing. You know, and I've talked to his brother, and it was hard talking to his family members about this. And especially when they did not know the details of the battle. And again, as a journalist, I can find these things out. I put together the story, and it took me forever to put together the piece of the battle of the story because so much time has gone by and everything else, and some of these guys haven't talked about it rightfully for so long. So then you go to one guy, he said, this happened. And, of course, you know, as a veteran, if I'm in a battle beside you, if I'm looking one way and then you're looking the other way, even though I'm standing beside each other, our recollection of the battle would be entirely different. So to take all that information and go back to
people. It's a whole different war in many cases.
Yeah. To take all that information and go back and forth and, you know, somebody said, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. And then to get the timeline right, it took forever. But I made sure the veterans read it. And I made sure it was 100% accurate for publishing anywhere. And to have the Davis family just read that was very hard. His sister called me before he got published. I sent her the combat chapters. She told me she cried all night, and I just cried when she told me that. It broke my heart. But I told her I wanted to know how heroic her brother was to the very end and how many, you know, the gift of life he'd given those five other Marines. And that goes on to rest of their lives as well. And it's the gift of life that keeps going. Like, one of the platoon commander who's standing beside Sergeant Davis is immediate right. He had curled up into a ball thinking he was going to die any second. He knew there was a second grenade there, but he didn't know where it was. He lived, he died of natural causes a few years ago. But I was at Marine Corps Base Quantico in November 2014 when his eldest grandchild graduated from OCS. He's now an active duty Marine Corps officer. He's a captain, stationed at Marine Corps Base Quantico. Isn't that amazing?
It is. I mean, I'm still amazed by the whole episode, it's not that this is the first time I've heard this type of bravery occur. It's just that it's just so awesome.
And it is, and the black and white aspect makes it even more remarkable. Like the Davis family, until I did the research and let them know officially 4 years ago at a family reunion, they had no idea that all five of those Marines were white. They just assumed that at least one or more maybe were African Americans because there was all these charges back then of so many African Americans, you know, being pushed up to the front. And so I wait to a family reunion to tell everybody in the Davis family all five of those Marines were white. Just seeing the look on their faces. Absolutely unbelievable.
What?
But to the Marines I talked with, it was never an issue. That's the beauty. They never said the black sergeant, the black or the white guy. They were just Marines. They were brothers in every sense of the word. Marine green was the only color they saw or cared about in those weeks in the Quezon Valley.
I think that's what's really important there is you're colorblind. You have to be colorblind in those situations. You know, you can't afford to bring politics into it or your upbringing into it or anything along those lines, because your entire being is to, you know, get rid of the enemy and in the meantime take care of your fellow soldiers.
Sure.
And
that was the beauty of the whole thing. Sergeant Davis never, you know, because America was such a segregated country in so many places. That was the first fully integrated war that Americans fought. So that was the first time Sergeant Davis had been around white people on a daily basis, like living among them before. And likewise, that was the first time many of those white Marines had been around an African American on a daily basis before. And what they found out is that they weren't that much different. They weren't different. They had the same hopes, the same fears, the same dreams, and we all bleed the same color red. You know.
Absolutely.
So the irony is, of course, these young men traveled more than 10,000 miles away from home and endured the closest thing there was to hell on earth, the experience, the kind of brotherhood that America was supposed to have been about in the first place, a place where a man's ability mattered more than the color of his skin, where his character superseded his pedigree. I mean, the irony here is unbelievable.
It is. And many of the people that I have talked to that, you know, with the military is one of these great equalizers because everybody from all over the country is thrown into a stew where, you know, you meet people from different parts of the country, you meet people from all different ethnic backgrounds, and, you know, it opens your eyes that, you know, that we are all Americans. We're all one unit,
Yep.
And that we can't afford to have all these other things going on in the meantime. And I want to get, before we run out of time here, I want to have you talk a little bit about what happened down in Macon after his death and after his funeral, and what has changed in Macon, if at all.
It's changed a lot. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, it's you know, a lot of ways, Macon, Georgia is still the same in some aspects. It's still very segregated. You know, they always say, especially Sunday, 11 a.m. is the most segregated hour in America. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of ways, it's very segregated, but in a lot of ways, it isn't. You know, there's a monument of Roddy Davis in front of the City Hall in Macon. It depicts him, a U.S. Marine in combat. It never mentions his race, and I like that. One thing I work with U.S. Marine veterans, Vietnam veterans, starting in September, starting in 2011, and by 2012, those through the height of the recession, they had raised $80,000. And of course, I've learned Marines do not take no for an answer. They raised $80,000. I helped, and with the media aspect, but we used $60,000 of that money to erect a memorial statue in Macon, Georgia, for Sergeant Roddy Davis. The other $20,000 we used to seed an annual scholarship for a student, high school student, in his name to go to college. There's nothing I've ever done that I've been more proud of, be a part of that project. And the entire city of Macon was on board. Literally, in fact, the day before, there was a big city-sponsored luncheon, and three of the survivors who were still alive who were in that trench were there that day. There wasn't a dry eye in the room as they met the Davis family, his siblings, and the loss became real for both sides. It was one of the most emotional days of my life that day.
I am sure that it is. When you find out or you meet somebody who saved you or that you saved along the way, it's those are really powerful opportunities. He also had a ship named after him.
He did. In 1987, the Navy commissioned USS Rodney M. Davis. It was an Oliver Hazard Perry class frigate. It served from 1987 to 2015 when the Navy retired the entire aging fleet of Perry class frigates. It was the first Navy warship named after an African American Medal of Honor recipient. There have been other ships named after African American Medal of Honor recipients, but they were not warships. They were mostly transports and stuff. This was the first warship named after an African American Medal of Honor recipient. So it was amazing. When aboard, I was still on active duty, I was up to visit the ship. I was going the bridge of the ship with the captain and took my son. And, it was just great, you know, be a part of that. And, this whole story has been it's been an adventure for me. It's taken me place like that. Literally, in working with and doing this book, the Davis family had been invited in 1969. President Nixon brought them up to the White House, presented the Medal of Honor. So, of course, as a journalist, I had no problem connecting with the White House communication staff, getting pictures and transcripts and all that stuff. And so that worked out great. Later, in 2015, I was invited to a Medal of Honor ceremony during the Obama White House. And I was sitting there maybe 10 feet from President Obama watching him present the Medal of Honor in front of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Most amazing thing I've ever sat through in my life. Gave me goosebumps.
I'm sure it will. We have a local gentleman who received a Medal of Honor, I think about that time period. And the people that went to the ceremony said it was unforgettable. It was so emotional, just unforgettable. Well, we were talking here with John Hollis, and John is the author of a book, Sergeant Rodney M. Davis, The Making of a Hero. It's probably available anywhere, Amazon and so forth, and I really encourage our audiences to take the time to read this book, and I think it will give you a really good insight, not only into Rodney Davis, but also into the world of the 1960s that many of us lived through, but many people don't remember what it's like anymore. So, John, I want to thank you very much for being on the program, and I wish you continued success. And let me know if you have any other books that come out. I think it's
good. Thank you, Dale. I appreciate it. I appreciate so much everything you do, and it's an honor to be on. Appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Wow. That's a great story as far as I'm concerned. That was John Hollis. He's the author of the book, Sergeant Rodney Davis, The Making of a Hero. It's very inspirational. And as you know, here on Veterans Radio, we have had the privilege of talking to surviving Medal of Honor recipients, and every single one of them sounded exactly like Sergeant Davis. You know, they're humble, and they just did what they had to do at the time. And, so many of them did not survive. And it talked about the idea of Sergeant Davis, you know, being an African American. He's one of 88 African Americans who have received the Medal of Honor. And I want you all to remember that. You know, our country is made up of a lot of different people. And the point is that we have one goal, and that is to be an American, and we want America that is free for everyone. In fact, I took a verse here from the Declaration of Independence, which I thought was very interesting, and I'm just going to read this, and we'll go out with our theme on that. This is from Thomas Jefferson. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator, a.k.a. God, with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Till next week, this is Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed.